This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and since you find us on the podcast, we know you are discerning listeners. Let's get to it. Here's today's show.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening on this Friday before you head out to your Memorial Day weekend. And to that end, later this hour, we'll talk about how to make a great Memorial Day picnic. And all this hour, we want you to finish this sentence. My summer officially begins when... Finish that sentence. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE and fill in the blank there. We'll put it on the air. But we begin this hour in Iraq and Syria with a look at just how far the self-proclaimed Islamic State has expanded its reach. ISIS militants now control the Syrian city of Palmyra. That's an ancient city and also a strategic one. It sits right near important gas fields. It's the first time the militant group has seized an entire city from Syrian government forces, and ISIS now controls more than half of that country, though a lot of that is uninhabited desert. But 5 days before, ISIS seized a much larger and important city in Iraq. That's Ramadi, the capital of Anbar province. Many, many lives of Americans and Iraqis were lost taking Ramadi from insurgents in the Iraq War. And now it's slipped from the Iraqi government once again. In an interview with The Atlantic this week, President Obama says he doesn't think the United States and its coalition is losing the war against ISIS. But he told The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg, quote, there's no doubt there was a tactical setback. Meanwhile, retired four-star Army General Jack Keane, who served as vice chief of staff of the Army, has a very different assessment. He had it yesterday when he testified in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee.
The resources provided to support Iraq are far from adequate. The timing and urgency to provide arms, equipment, and training is insufficient. And as such, we are not only failing, we are in fact losing this war. Moreover, I can say with certainty that this strategy will not defeat ISIS.
So for a look at the Islamic State's expansion in Iraq and Syria and what it all means for our foreign policy agenda, we want to turn now to Ali Kaderi. He's chairman and chief executive of Dragomin Partners, and he served as special assistant to five American ambassadors in Iraq and as a senior advisor to three heads of central command from 2003 to 2010. Ali Kaderi, one assessment from the White House that we heard there says the strategy is sound and that Ramadi is a mere setback. And another, voiced by Jack Keane, says that ISIS will never be defeated without coalition troops on the ground, and that Iraq, with the United States and other countries behind it, is losing to ISIS. So what's your assessment?
I completely agree with General Keane. The reality is that the United States clearly does not have a strategy in Iraq, nor in Syria, nor for Iran, nor for the entire Middle East. Since we don't have a comprehensive strategy, we're not properly resourcing it. We don't have the right people assigned to the mission. And as a result, our strategic enemies, whether Iran supporting radical militant Shia or Al-Qaeda and ISIS, radical militant Sunnis, they are both getting stronger as us and our allies get weaker.
Why isn't the stated White House strategy, which is advisors on the ground, limited airstrikes, the occasional special operations move in Syria or Iraq to take out ISIS leaders and support for the Iraqi army, why isn't that a strategy?
Well, first, let's go back to the issue of the assumptions. You recall for years now, since President Obama took office, he said Iraq was, quote, sovereign, independent, that it had a good government in Baghdad, so on and so forth. In reality, of course, none of that was the case. And so eventually things melted down, as was the case in Mosul last summer, and then yet again in Ramadi this week. So the assumptions are fundamentally flawed. But the issue is all of these military resources are just good resources that are being thrown after bad, because the problems in Iraq go back to the issue of governance. Because you have a government that is seen as illegitimate by millions of Iraqis, this problem is fundamentally political. It is not military. So all the entire United States Army could go into Iraq today, and like happened for most of the past decade, it would be bogged down in a quagmire. Until the president recognizes that this is a political problem that needs political reconciliation in Baghdad, that needs less Iranian malign involvement in Baghdad, and less of a proxy war throughout the region, until that recognition is in place, we will continue to face or face major strategic setbacks as occurred in Mosul and in Ramadi, and we will have many more, I assure you.
I think that a lot of Americans who've been paying attention to this, certainly a lot of lawmakers on Capitol Hill and people in Washington, thought that the politically legitimate ouster of Nouri al-Maliki from the top of the Baghdad government, if you will, was a move to exactly what you're talking about, a more legitimate government within Iraq that would have more respect of regular Iraqi citizens and marginalize the type of ideology and legitimacy that ISIS was bringing to a lot of Sunnis. But that apparently hasn't happened.
The removal of Prime Minister Maliki last summer was a major success. However, we have to recognize that after 8 years in power, Maliki essentially destroyed the Iraqi national identity through his misrule, following 3 decades of Saddam Hussein's own misrule and genocide and corruption and murder. At this point, after the White House backed Maliki for 4 years under Obama, despite many of us urging the president not to do so, essentially the cancer has already spread, it's metastasized, and the president is trying to basically pop a few Tylenols to defeat brain cancer. But the cancer has already spread, and although Maliki has been removed, most of the government in Baghdad is sort of too far gone and clearly has not demonstrated the will to treat all Iraqis as first-class citizens. And so again, that's why 90% of our resources and our time and our energy needs to be spent on focusing on reforming the Iraqi government to the extent it's possible. And the other 10 or 20% needs to be focused on the military's resources as enablers, as supporters. Right now, it's the opposite, which is why we continue to fail. Again, the vast majority of the Iraqi army, which is Shia, clearly doesn't see their government as worth fighting for, worth dying for. And that should be deeply troubling. And that should force lawmakers to think, why would we ever send American troops into Iraq when the Iraqi army itself is not willing to fight for its own country?
But at the same time, you agree with General Jack Keane, who we played at the top, in addition to the major political reforms that you're talking about. Look, he's a military man. He also says the reality is that ISIS will never go away unless the United States recognizes that reality and mobilizes a division on the ground in Iraq. That's not going to happen while President Obama's here. We know that. But he's saying that will happen in the future or ISIS will stay around.
I believe that so long as the current regime exists in Baghdad, so long as the current regime exists in Damascus, and so long as thus the injustice, the lack of dignity continues, that ISIS will exist. And you can again send the entire American military into those countries, and all we will be doing is being dragged down into another quagmire. The absolute 80% emphasis of the United States government and our allies should be on the politics. And then, yes, we can send in special operations forces, trainers, to enable them after to take advantage of the political successes. But we absolutely should not send in a division or even, you know, a single American combat troop until the government in Baghdad and in Damascus has a new way of doing business, which is treating all of its citizens as first-class citizens. Because ISIS is a symptom of the underlying cancer, which is poor governance.
While battles rage in places like Palmyra and Ramadi across Syria and Iraq, Ali Kaderi says it's not about military confrontation in the end. It's about good politics. Ali Kaderi, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Ali Kaderi is chairman and chief executive of Dragomin Partners. He served as a special assistant to 5 American ambassadors and 3 heads of the Central Command from 2003 to 2010. In California, the cleanup continues along 9 miles of coastline of Santa Barbara after a ruptured pipeline spilled tens of thousands of gallons of crude oil into the Pacific earlier this week. According to an analysis from the LA Times, Plains Pipeline, the company in charge of that ruptured pipe, has racked up 175 violations over the last 9 years. The company's rate of violations per mile of pipeline is more than 3 times the national average. Here's Captain Jennifer Williams of the U.S. Coast Guard at a news conference yesterday talking about efforts to skim oily water out of the ocean.
They'll go out with pairs of vessels with boom in between, try to collect the oil in there and skim it up. It's a moving target when you're talking about oil on the water. It's a very difficult process.
A moving target, says Captain Williams. State Senator Hannah Beth Jackson represents California's 19th district in Sacramento, which includes Santa Barbara, and she joins me now. Senator, welcome.
Hello, Todd.
Give us your latest assessment or what you've heard from the Coast Guard or authorities there on the extent of the damage to Santa Barbara's beaches and the water there and the wildlife.
Well, you know, figuring out the extent of the damage is something that's going to take weeks and months to determine, because the cleanup alone is not going to get rid of all of the oil. Some of it will seep down into the water. Some of it is so thick and viscous that it will permeate into the sand. The impacts on wildlife are yet to be known, our fisheries and so forth. So that assessment is a very difficult one. What we do know is that they are working hard to clean up as much of the oil as they can. Of the 21,000 gallons, they estimate they've cleaned up about 8,800 gallons. So there's still a lot of work to do. And with the tides and with the currents, this oil slick is potentially going to move down the coast to other beaches and impact other fisheries and wildlife as well.
And what have you been hearing from Plains All American Pipeline? That's the company that was operating this above ground pipeline, apparently below capacity from what that line can carry. They've been making statements to the press that they report all of their spills, that they exceed federal regulations when they can. What have you been hearing from them?
Well, of course, part of the big concern that we all have is why it took so long. Under the rules in Santa Barbara County, all pipelines are supposed to have an automatic shutoff valve. This is the only pipeline in the entire county that does not have an automatic shutoff valve. And frankly, it's because about 20 years ago, they sued the county because they didn't want to be subject to the county's regulatory oversight, and they won. So the fact that that pipeline took several hours to shut off because of their efforts to try to avoid their regulatory responsibilities is something that has caused great concern for us in the community.
And what have you heard from officials in your community about potential health concerns for people? We've certainly seen the images of the beach and of wildlife. Certainly environmental damage is another conversation. What about the health of the residents?
Well, obviously, they don't want people near those beaches, so they have been closed, and they're cautioning people that they really are discouraging volunteers to come down and try to work with the seabirds and the sea life. You notice that the cleanup crews are wearing toxic outfits, hazmat outfits. Oil is, particularly crude oil, is a very toxic and dangerous substance, and until this is cleaned up, they're really discouraging. We're all discouraging people from going near those areas where we're seeing the oil coming up on shore.
Give us a sense of the geography in your town, if you would. Was this pipeline running right along the beach? Santa Barbara has a beautiful beach and then cliffs, and there are houses above those cliffs. At least that's the pictures that we see of beautiful Santa Barbara all the time. Where does that pipeline run, and how did it break?
Well, the pipeline is in an area, relatively pristine area, about 20 miles actually west of most of the development in Santa Barbara, part of a well-maintained sort of open space that we have fought very hard to preserve. And the pipelines, there's a lot of oil up in that area. The bottom line is that not only is this a beautiful and pristine place, but it's also a place where there is a lot of oil. So we see oil drilling, oil development. We see a lot of pipes that transport that oil from both onshore and offshore to the refineries. This was onshore, but not that far from the actual coast itself. So the pipeline broke onshore and seeped into the ocean because the cutoff was not quick enough, and the effort to try to stop the flow of the oil into the ocean did not occur as quickly as would be necessary in order to stop the flow right out into the beach and into the ocean.
Senator, we talked yesterday on this show about the legacy of the 1969 oil spill off of Santa Barbara and the environmental legacy that came from it. This is a smaller disaster, but it has to be a horrible reminder for people in your town.
It's like opening a wound. And of course, we have been trying for quite some time to reduce our dependence on oil. We have there's this big effort to become nationally energy independent, which means drilling more and drilling more. But in my district, we are very sensitive to the detrimental impacts that oil drilling can have and has had on our beautiful, pristine coastline. You know, for us, not only is this a quality of life issue, but the coast and our beauty really is a source of economic well-being for tourism. In fact, right before the holiday, we had thousands of people who had reserved places up at our two gorgeous state beaches, yeah. El Capitan and El Refugio, and now they've had to cancel those plans. So we are very sensitive. This is right between two marine protected areas on the coast. And for us, we really believe we have to do more to wean ourselves off of oil and get rid of this dangerous material. You know, they say oil and water do not mix, and they certainly do not mix along the ocean.
State Senator Hannah Beth Jackson in Santa Barbara, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Since 1950, the afternoon and evening news broadcasts on the RTE network in Ireland have begun the same way every single day, with a minute of silence followed by this. Those are church bells, and the ringing of those bells, linked to the Catholic Angelus prayer, has long been a reminder of the devout religious beliefs of a nation where 85% of citizens self-identify as Roman Catholic. But even in a country where the church has played such a significant role, today the people of Ireland will vote on a referendum on same-sex marriage, and if it passes, Ireland will amend its constitution and become the first nation to support gay marriage by popular vote. And opinion polls indicate that it might happen. Up to 70% of Irish people are in favor of marriage equality. At least that's what they tell the pollsters. Well, here with some cultural insights on Ireland and Catholicism and the potentially historic vote is Des Bishop. He's an Irish-American comedian who's lived in Ireland since his mid-teens, and he joins us now from Dublin. Hi, Des.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. You know, I think a lot of people outside Ireland especially are pretty surprised that Catholic Ireland could be the first country to legalize gay marriage by popular vote here.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not as surprising in Ireland because, you know, Ireland has been transformed, certainly since 1990 when I came here. You know, like for everywhere else around the world, it's like you haven't seen Ireland in 20 years. Ireland steps off the plane. You're like, oh, my God, Ireland, you've changed so much. You don't look anything like what I thought you would look like.
And yet you mentioned the early 90s. It was only in 1993 that Ireland got rid of its laws outlawing homosexuality.
I know. And even later than that, that you could sell porno mags. I mean, when I came to Ireland in 1990, very quickly, there was a major scandal where Bishop Eamon Casey got in trouble because it turned out he had a child, you know, and that he was using church funds to support that child. And then that sort of began a snowball of events where very quickly people realized that the church had abused its power in many more sinister ways, as we all know. We don't need to go through that. But that has led to certainly people of my generation, like I'm 39, people of my generation don't have a great sort of allegiance to the Catholic Church. The generation behind us, I don't see a deep connection there at all. And then you still have an older generation that some people have been let down and moved on and other people are holding on. But it feels like the minority of people are still holding on to what was there when I first arrived in 1990.
So we have you in Dublin, of course. Put yourself, you know, in Rome for a second. If you're the Holy See looking at one of your stalwart Catholic countries, traditionally Ireland, all of a sudden turning around, possibly voting to legalize gay marriage on a national level, and an entire generation, which, as you say, is kind of turning its back on the church, what might they think today?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know because Pope Francis, to some extent, seems to be a bit more liberal. You know, the No campaign here, they're really obsessed with the welfare of children. And anyone who really cares about children knows that the greatest threat to children is poverty. And, you know, in fairness to the Catholic Church, it's probably the one area where they still sort of they can hold their head proud and say, yes, we try to work for poverty. It seems so strange that still in this day and age that they would be so obsessed with sex. I don't know where it began. I don't know why it still exists. If they have any intelligence at all, they must be sitting there saying, guys, at some stage, I think we need to maybe change tact.
Times have changed and we need to change with them, maybe, or at least not stand in the way, I guess.
Well, yeah, but I mean, listen, they can the holy C word. They can do whatever they want. I could care less about them. You know, they don't influence my life and a lot of people, my contemporaries' lives at all.
Okay, well, that's part of the question then, because does that mean that Ireland still remains sort of culturally Catholic but far less religious, or is people's religion now sort of internal and in the home, or is religion kind of in a way going away in Ireland?
I think to a degree, I mean, this is just the voice of one person, but I think to a degree religion is going away in Ireland. I mean, I'm a comedian. I like to talk about lighthearted things, but something quite sinister happened here, you know? Like, there was really a lot of bad sexual abuse scandals that came out. In fact, the school that I went to, my principal went to jail. You know, he was in my house, came to visit us in Flushing, Queens, the summer of 1991. It turned out he was on his way to a rehab for sexual behavior in Florida. I only found that out when I read the Ferns report, which was like the first main report about sexual abuse scandals in Ireland. So people are less religious because religion let them down like heavily here.
They're less religious. How skeptical are they? The polls say that 70% of Irish people are in favor of marriage equality. Does that translate to 70% on voting day, do you think?
Well, let's see. I mean, let's be more positive, because there's a really beautiful thing happening in Ireland today. Like, if you go on Twitter, you look at Home to Vote is one hashtag, Home to Vote, Vote Yes. There's various different hashtags, but Home to Vote particularly is very moving, because in Ireland, it's very hard to have a postal ballot. Most of the time, you have to go back, not just to Ireland, but you have to go to your hometown to vote. And people have been coming from all over the world. There's pictures all throughout last night and throughout today of people coming to the airports, coming on boats, interviews with people, you know, 18 hours getting from, you know, from London to Holyhead and then on the ferry and then a bus to Cork. You know, there's incredible stories of people coming back to vote. I mean, younger people particularly are very engaged by this. So you feel like if young people vote in their droves, which it looks like it's happening, then there's a great possibility for a yes vote. But I've never felt that 70% was the number because, you know, people are afraid to seem non-progressive. Everyone has a genuine right. If they want a no vote, that is absolutely fine, you know. But a lot of people are afraid to sort of come out and say, you know, I just don't believe in this. They don't want to seem to be that person. So it's really hard to say. And I would have had a lot of fears until I saw the numbers, because the numbers are really up in Ireland.
Des Bishop is an Irish-American comedian and, for the purposes of this show, cultural correspondent in Dublin. Des, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, all you need to know for the perfect Memorial Day picnic. But first, what marks the start of your summer?
Hi, this is Kim from Southeast Florida. And my summer officially begins when the humidity reaches 80%.
Hi, my name's Alice from Spokane, Washington, and my summer officially starts when I no longer have to make 5 school lunches every morning. Yahoo!
Hi, my name is Ilse. I'm calling from Louisville, Kentucky. My summer officially starts when that hammock goes up in the backyard.
My name's Natalie, and I'm calling from Bend. And my summer officially starts when I can leave my windows open at night, wear a dress in the evening without being cold, and when jumping into the river sounds like a good idea.
8778MYTAKE is the number. You can tweet us at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing basic tools for individuals and business owners to make a website. Squarespace includes hosting, 24/7 customer support, and more. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway.
It's Memorial Day. It's summertime, everyone, and no one does a picnic basket quite like Yogi Bear.
Boo Boo! I think it's time I introduce myself to that picnic basket.
You know, Yogi, we could just hunt for food. All the other animals do.
Boo Boo! A picnic basket has everything a bear needs. And I'm not just talking about the treats and snack-type goodies. No, a picnic basket holds a lot more than that. It holds dreams.
Well, here to make your picnic basket dreams come true, the Boo Boo to our Yogi. That's right, Dan Pashman. And if you're planning to head to the park this Memorial Day weekend, we want to give you some tips on how to do your picnicking just right. Dan Pashman, of course, is host of WNYC's Sporkful Food Podcast and the Cooking Channel's web series, You're Eating It Wrong. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Todd.
Sorry for making you the boo-boo to our yogi, but that's okay.
That's cool. Just make sure you keep that extra syllable in there. It's picnic.
Yes.
That's how Yogi says it.
In the true Sporkful fashion, we don't want to leave out any of the minute details.
That's right.
Of the very best of the picnicking experience. So what are you recommending this Memorial Day? You know, some people like to go light, paper bag from the grocery store with some cold cuts and bread, which is fine. Some people have the full-on, you know, wicker picnic basket with champagne glasses and actual silverware, a nice blanket. You can go one of a number of ways here.
Yeah, I mean, I think you roughly outlined the minimalist and the maximalist. And I think if I have one overarching philosophy with picnics or picnics, it's that you should pick one or the other. Where you don't want to be is in the middle. Either go for convenience, the lightest possible amount of stuff to transport, you go minimalist. And also with the minimalist, your goal is the empty-handed walk away. So you have to leave everything there. We could talk more about how to do that. With the maximalist, you're really going for luxury. Mm-hmm. And you want to set up a spread that's going to, you know, blow you and your fellow picnickers away.
Going a bit lighter, though, realistically, most of us are going to do a much lighter picnic, much more packing light, let's say, for sandwiches or burgers or cold cuts. What else can you do?
Well, if you're going for the minimalist and if your goal is the empty-handed walk away, I would say no salad at all. Nothing that requires utensils. Let's say you want to do sandwiches. You start off with sandwiches. Cut them into small pieces. Don't just cut them into halves. Cut them into quarters if it's on square bread or if it's on a long roll. Cut it into one-inch wide slivers. Open up the foil that it's wrapped in and just put it down on the blanket and let people just pick up little slivers and eat with their hands. Now, you didn't need to bring plates. You didn't need utensils. You're saving a lot of garbage and you're carrying a lot less. But if you want to go even one step further, you can also remove the need for napkins by doing something I call the tooth picnic. The tooth picnic is where you pre-cut every piece of food into a bite-sized morsel. So you could grill steaks before you leave and cube them up and put them into a container. You can cut up fruit. You can cut up brownies. You can put anything into little balls and cubes. And then you just give each person one toothpick.
I have been concerned about a lot of people I see in the park and on the beach using their iPhones for music directly. I think there's no call for this, especially in the age of Bluetooth speakers. Very small, compact, rectangular, if you can get your hands on one, some kind of Bluetooth speaker makes the picnic much more enjoyable. iPhones are great, but that speaker just doesn't cut it outdoors.
I think that's absolutely right. But I will say that if you're in a pinch and if you don't have those speakers, if you put your phone into almost any kind of spherical object, like stick it into a bowl or an empty Pringles can with the speaker facing down, it will act as a makeshift amplifier.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, and you can just amplify it for the whole blanket, because blanket-wide coverage.
That's right.
Of the Sporkful podcast or whatever else it is you're listening to.
Is there something else to listen to?
I'm sometimes tragically non-detail oriented, especially on picnic days, celebratory days like that, because of, you know, let your hair down, I'm not at work. I bring the bottle of wine because who could forget that? And I sometimes forget the opener. This has happened.
I mean, the first thing I'll say is try to remember to just uncork your wine before you leave the house and just stick the cork back in and then it's open and you're ready to go. But if you're really in a pinch and you're at the park and you don't have the corkscrew, you can't open a bottle of wine with a shoe and any hard vertical surface like a tree trunk. You can Google it. There's many videos on YouTube. But essentially, you peel off the wrapper on the top of the wine.
The foil, yeah.
The foil. You stick the bottle of wine into the shoe as if it were your leg. You turn it perpendicular and just bang it firmly. You're banging the bottom of the shoe and the wine into the side of a tree. And slowly but surely, the cork will begin to stick out. And you can pull it out with your hand.
Pull it right out. I don't see any reason why I can't do this in the kitchen.
Or right now.
Or right now, as soon as we finish this segment. Dan Pashman, I love it. Now, before we let you go, let's do a little bit of a top five, the top five things that Dan says need to be in your picnic basket this Memorial Day weekend.
I would say, well, number one, toothpicks.
Of course.
Number two, one good knife. Because even if you pre-cut everything, and even if you think you're totally prepared, there's always going to be something you're going to need to cut. I recommend a good knife that comes with its own sheath.
Great. Number three.
A Sharpie marker.
Sharpie.
Because if you're dealing with plastic cups, one of the most annoying things at a group event is you pour yourself a drink and you put it down and you don't remember which one's yours.
And pretty soon you run out because nobody wants to get grossed out.
That's right. So you're wasting cups, you're wasting liquids, and it's tragic. Bring a Sharpie and have everyone write their name on their cup when they get their drink, and that's your cup for the day.
And be the hero at the beginning of the picnic to walk around with the Sharpie, and everybody says, oh, you thought of it.
That's right.
Even though you forgot the corkscrew.
Yeah, that's right. But you remembered the shoe.
All right, number four.
Number four, a shoe.
So we can open our wine. And number five?
Well, it's not the most glamorous, but it's practical, Todd. A garbage bag.
Oh, of course.
You need something to throw it out in. That's why I like with the minimalist picnic, if you bring everything in a couple paper shopping bags from the supermarket, recycled. Those can then double as garbage bags.
See, nobody ever plans for the hangover.
That's right.
Yeah, but if you do, you'll be happier. Yeah. Dan Pashman is host of WNYC's Sporkful Food Podcast and also the Cooking Channel's web series, You're Eating It Wrong. And he is our picnic guru for this Memorial Day. Dan Pashman, thanks, man.
That's picnic.
Picnic. And here's a little something, maybe a word or two to take with you today. Hey, have you ever had a fight like this at home?
Buckety?
It's not a word.
Of course it is. It means of or pertaining to or having the characteristics of a bucket.
Gosh, that sounds like my house like every Saturday night. That comes to us from the old sitcom Roseanne. Now, if you're a traditionalist, you might not want to hear this, but 6,500 words have been added to Scrabble's official dictionary this week. And these are not SAT words. Listen, how about pwn, P-W-N, for 8 words? Thanks with an X. You think all this sounds ridic, ending with a C? Yeah, you're not alone. That's 8 points for the ridiculous shortening of a word. As an avid Scrabble player myself, I gotta say, this isn't that surprising a move from a game that's been around since 1949. They've added words through the decades to keep Scrabble players on their toes, but also really to keep people talking about Scrabble, it seems. Remember a year or two ago when Scrabble said they'd allow commercial words and brand names and everybody freaked out? Guys, they might be trolling us. Remember that before you write your angry letter into Scrabble, although I do encourage you to do it. That's all for today, but we want you to get an early jump on all of our conversations, be part of our listener response network by signing up for our text. You get one text a day where we ask you a question that's featured on the next day's show, and that's so that your voice becomes part of the on-air conversation. All you have to do is text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866, and when you text us back, those texts sometimes get on the air. Standard messaging rates apply, of course. Well, thanks so much for listening. Have a great holiday weekend and stay off the roads if you can. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. John is back next week. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.